I mean, but everyone needs to face it. Your grandparents fucked and they had foreplay and they talked dirty to each other. Everybody needs to know that.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life. When the words all come down, like blues on Tuesdays come down. Throw it all away.
Throw it all away. Welcome to another World War II deep dive episode of American Timelines by History for Jerks, and this is part two of the biography deep dives from 1942 with my special guest, pilot and pants shitter, Hunter Brame. Let's hear it for Hunter Brame, everybody. Thanks for being here, Hunter Brame.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to
you
be
here. You came back.
Again.
I didn't piss you off enough to get you to never come back.
Well, you know, I did all the talking last time. You have to do all the talking.
Yeah, now I have to talk and you just have to listen.
Exactly.
Or interrupt, or
I'll just be silent the whole
laugh.
Time.
Yeah. Well, you have an AI filter that's going to keep you silent, from what I understand.
No, it's turned off now. We're raw dogging.
So we're going to raw dog
every bit.
And so this is Hunter. He has bots that he's created. He has AIs that he's downloaded that run his life. As far as I know, he's half computer, half man. Yeah. He's basically RoboCop. Only he's not a cop. He's a pilot. And I remember from last episode, he told us about a time where he almost shit his pants flying, and you have an updated story. I thought there was something else you were going to bring up. You were going to tell me about this time that we didn't get to.
So I didn't shit my pants, but I did have a moment where I was like, well, I'll kind of like tell the story and you'll know the point where it's like, oh shit. Like things have changed for the flight.
Yeah.
So I flew to the beach the other week. Me and my buddy took a bonanza from Monroe Airport.
Hold on.
Yes.
Let me just tell the listeners real quick. This is the thing he just told me that this new pilot that just learned to fly during the pandemic, which was just last week, basically. He got all his flight hours and he's trying to convince me to get in an airplane with him and fly to a barbecue restaurant and then fly back to Charlotte. I told Hunter that all I've been doing for 6 years is doing podcasts about plane crashes, small planes always crashing, colliding with terrain, as you say it. Anyway, so that's a little side bit. And what the hell's a bonanza?
So a bonanza is a normally it's a four-seater with a cargo space, but some of the newer models take away some of that cargo room and put six seats in it.
Okay, so is a bonanza a model or is it a... is a type of plane, like
it's like the, yes, it would be the model, like there's
okay, so when you say like
different than cars,
JC27, like there's a bonanza is a certain thing,
yes.
And
okay. exactly. So I was flying the bonanza with my buddy who's also a pilot, and
okay,
we
was there any
lunch.
Romantic involvement with this?
No,
this trip
no,
at all.
We're just buddies.
Just
we're just leeching flight hours.
So
off
not.
Of
what do you mean leeching off of each other? Like one of you flies there, one of you flies back.
No. Well,
or does it count as a flight hour if you're a passenger?
It's very complicated, like all things with the FAA are. So the big thing for any pilot is you're trying to get to 1500 hours. Mm-hmm. That's where you can get your ATP or airline transport pilot license.
Okay.
And really, like the airlines don't even start looking at you until normally around 1,000 hours. They'll pull you up to be a first officer, like training in the second seat next to a captain to get those last few hours to 1500.
Right.
But it's expensive to get those hours. And until I get 250, my commercial license, I can't get paid for any of the stuff that I do. I'm just shelling money out.
So you're just you're still sort of a learner.
Yes.
You and he,
there's a way that we can split hours.
Okay.
We don't have to get into deep detail about that.
You know how to do that? It's not illegal.
It's not illegal. The FAA leaves a very broad gray area. area for that. I
on
think
purpose.
My opinion on purpose, yes, to kind of cut down on the expense of flying.
Gotcha.
So we're flying together. We go to the beach. We get lunch. Grab some seafood.
And you don't drink at all during this.
Don't drink at all. And I think I told you this, right? Like my first reaction, like stepping up to the bar where I'm supposed to be ordering my food, was looking at their beer selection and then thinking like, oh, I can't touch any of this.
Yeah.
Okay. So we get seafood. I go dip my toes in the water.
So you can't have one beer and fly?
No.
You can't have any.
There's not even like a, so I think legally, I don't even play around with it. That's why I'm like,
yeah, you just won't know. Yeah, right.
I think it's 0.04 is our legal limit. So it's half of the driving limit.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's also a time limit. You can't have anything to drink 8 hours before a flight.
Oh, good. That's safe.
And I normally, my like personal safety limit is 12 hours. So I don't even try and get close.
Okay.
Cause it'd be stupid to lose your license over something silly like that.
Yeah. Like, something like just having a beer one time when you can just not do it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Anyway, you're at the bar, you're going through the IPAs and you're like, oh, I love IPAs, even though they give me cramps in my legs. Mm-hmm.
You remember that? You really do like me, Joe.
I care about you, man. I listen. I'm a listener. Mm-hmm. And I edited you saying that 14 times. Oh no, that you said that somewhere else, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, you're with this guy. You're not romantically involved, even though he might kind of be into you.
Now, Brian's a good guy. Shout out, Brian. I do have a shout out.
Oh, Brian Anton from work.
No, not that.
Oh.
So
that guy rules, though.
We go back to the plane after lunch and load up all our stuff, get headed back to Charlotte, and we make it all the way back, no problems. I get in the traffic pattern at our local airport and I go to put the landing down as part of like a pre-landing checklist.
When you say in the traffic pattern, when you get close, you have to just circle the airport for a while until so
there's like a rectangular track that you follow.
Really?
When you get close,
it's rectangular.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously like curved on the corners.
Yeah, but you kind of just go in like an oblong. Okay.
Yeah. New pilots, it looks like more like an oval, but a good one is more rectangular.
It's going to do more. Yeah.
Yeah. 90 degree angles.
That's cool.
So
learning.
So we get back in the pattern and I'm trying to run through the pre-flight or pre-landing checklist, and I go to put the landing gear down, and lo and behold, one of the lights on the panel that indicates whether or not your gear is actually deployed. So there's three of them, three green lights that you want to light up. And like part of the like auditory checklist is three green, down and locked. So I set
Say
the
that
landing.
Again. Three green. What?
Three green, down and locked. So when those green, lights, down,
that means your landing gear is down and you're ready and you're going to land with wheels. Yeah, the wheels will work and help.
So one of those lights did not light up. and the reason there's three is because there's three landing gears. You got the nose wheel and then the two out on the wing.
Either side. Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was the left one that did not light up. And I turned to my pilot buddy, and this I was kind of happy with myself because of my response. There was no panic.
There was no poop.
There was no poop. I turned to I said, "Well, this just got interesting."
Yeah.
And he looks back at me, and he was like, "Yeah, it kind of did." And so you know, I start thinking through my head, like, "What all am I gonna do? What's my game plan here?
How quick do I jump out?"
No,
I would have jumped out at that point.
Yeah. And so he kind of leans forward and he taps the bulb of the light.
Yeah.
It clicks right on. It had wiggled out at some point.
So it was just the bulb. So the gear was down. Yeah, but you completely trust that? You completely just trust that little the light must have been off. What if that would have been the wheels on? At this point, I would have said, every man for himself, push him out of the way, grab the one life preserver, the one light, one parachute and just go and say, sorry, pal. Should have been romantically involved with me.
There's lots of tests. So obviously it could be down, but maybe not locked. So, you know, maybe you touch down and all of a sudden that landing gear collapses on that side.
Yeah.
No. So
see, all these things could be good, go wrong. This is where you say, oh, it could go wrong. These are things that could go wrong.
Yeah, but like anything in a plane, like there's a checklist for everything. So you start going through like
things. What's that checklist going to do if the damn gear doesn't come down? What are you going to do if it didn't come down? That checklist, so, what's that going to do? Flip it down with paper?
There's so many. So there's a manual gear extension. Uh-huh. There's like a lever in the back that I can crank and will lower the gear.
But if you're by yourself, you got to leave the plane unattended while you're cranking levers.
No, so I can reach it. It's like behind my seat.
Oh, okay. I can reach it. Gotcha.
I would probably have Brian take the flight controls while I crank. So I'm not like, you know, like jerking around while I'm trying to crank this.
Would you have said Jesus take the wheel and then do that?
No, Brian take the wheel. No. Yeah, the first thing is literally what Brian did is check the light bulbs, make sure they're good.
That that's a common thing, that those light bulbs just don't come on sometimes, that's concerning to me.
Well, and when I get to the next checklist item, you'll kind of understand why one was loose. So the next thing you check is if that bulb is burnt out.
Do those bulbs change and burn out?
in the glove compartment, you normally keep one or two extra bulbs, but even if I didn't have an extra bulb, I could just swap two of them. So I could pull the one out that I knew was lit up and put it into that one to see if it's a bulb that's burnt out.
Oh my gosh.
So they're kind of loose, you know, like you can pop them in and out interchangeably.
Feels like they should maybe have a more foolproof way that you shouldn't have to be changing light bulbs. Like, so you're in the air. You're going to die soon.
Some planes have a small mirror on the wing so you can see underneath.
That's helpful. Like, I think that's a good idea. Whoever invented that.
Now, like I said, it could be down, but not locked, which could be dangerous as well. You know, like if I could see that it was down, and that was going to be my next thing, was I was going to lap over the airport, call someone on the ground and say, hey, Can you look and see if my landing gear's down?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. You're gonna call someone, hey, Mark, don't be alarmed. Just drive to the airport and you'll see me looping around. I need you to tell me. Now, let me ask you this. I've always wondered this. Why can't you just, like, if I had to fly tomorrow, I would never put the landing gear up. I just leave it down. That way I know it's going to be down. Why do you have to put it up? Is it aerodynamics? Speed.
Yeah, speed is the biggest thing.
So you can leave it down and just go slow.
You could. I mean, it would not be good for the landing gear, for one, on a retractable gear plane. So
some of these have they just stay, right? Those little planes and whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, the plane we're gonna go in, it's
you got fleas? I ain't doing this. You're giving me more and more reasons not to do this.
But everything went well and I was calm, cool, collected, you know, handled it.
Yeah. If they give me 6 months to live.
And barbecue, Joe. Barbecue.
I like barbecue, but now I have to risk my life for it. Ugh. And if I can't even drink four beers, forget it.
You can drink. That's no problem.
Oh, what if you're passed out? Then I'm hammered drunk and you're passed out at the wheel and I got to fly this
Jesus
plane.
Take the wheel.
Jesus would take the wheel at that point.
Yeah.
We call if it you a yoke, even start, Joe. If you, it's if, a you yoke. If you did drive me and you started yawning even, I would be like, every man for himself, and I would push you aside. I'd grab the parachute and I'd be gone.
I've been my girlfriend Natalie flies with me. She hasn't flown with me in a while. But anyways.
Is that a sign of trouble in the relationship?
Nah, it's just I've been doing more like training flights and not like flying for fun.
Gotcha.
But I've been thinking about sending her to this class that's called the pinch hitter class.
Yeah.
That basically teaches you the most basics.
Just the basics to not crash.
What if something happened to me, you know, like turbulence, I smack my head on the window and get knocked out or something.
Again, more reasons why I'm not doing this.
You'd be perfectly fine, Joe.
I'm a grade A panicker. I am worst case scenario from go.
Joe, I believe that in a shit situation, I believe you would pull out. I think you'd be fine.
I don't know, man. Not on a plane. Not on a plane. No.
You'd just be panicking. You just give up.
Oh, is I would give up immediately and just push the thing down, straight down, nose down. Just land this now.
See, that at least shows me that you have an idea of how a plane works.
The way down. Said, I would just crash
nose. Push over and dive. Like, that means you at least know, hey, pull back if you don't
want to. Well, I've seen Three Amigos. I mean, hey, Three Amigos is all of my flight knowledge. Yeah. Which possibly the greatest movie of all time.
Some people have less than that, Joe. Some people believe that planes flying is magic. No, some people, like they the Lord, just they're like, oh yeah, it's magic. Yeah, the Lord. Yeah,
it is pretty magical. I mean, that we figure that out. Like,
we looked at birds all the time. You know, that's probably how we figured it out. Da Vinci, you know, his little paintings and stuff.
Yeah, that's how we figure. But it's the engine that's amazing to me. It's like, and those engines could fail at any moment. And you hit a bird or whatever. Well, that's fascinating. I could ask you a million flight questions. Maybe we'll just do this every time we do. Like, maybe I'll just keep you here as a biography / shitting your pants in the airplanes podcast. Actually, maybe you should spin off your own podcast on History for Jerks, just shitting your pants at 30,000 feet or 10,000 feet. Oh, God, 30, how many 000? Feet? Like, what's the highest?
9,000 is the highest I've been. Oh, 9,000.
Yeah. Where does a regular commercial plane go?
Like 30 plus. Yeah.
But yeah. It's a 30,000. So 30,000 is the.
Yeah. 14,000, you have to start considering oxygen.
Okay. How many feet is in a mile?
Don't ask me this. Like,
because the Mile High Club, do you have to be a certain thing to be in the Mile High Club, or is the Mile High Club just going to lose? Like, you could get in the Mile High Club.
But you need to be in a plane.
That's it. You know, that kind of, and it has to be airborne.
Yeah. But no,
so Americans, that said, it, that's, 5, this should have been my first question. I can't believe this wasn't my first question. Are you in the Mile High Club?
No. I had to think about it for a second.
You and Brian need to just
get just, it over with.
Yeah, just break get
the
over
ice, guys. Come on.
And you have to break to your girlfriend.
I'm going
to
send this to Brian now.
You have to break to your girlfriend. Sorry. Sorry, Han, I'm in the Mile High Club.
With me again.
But I also cheated on you with Brian. Yeah. Not gay, but just want to get in the club. You know, it's a very exclusive club. All right. With that, are you ready to jump into Native American history?
Yeah, I'm pouring my next glass of whiskey, so let's go.
Dewey Beard. This is about Dewey Beard. Yeah, what better thing to do is to get a little drunk on a Wednesday night and record a podcast about 1940s history.
What are you saying about Native Americans, Joe?
And racism and, So we've talked a lot about, I know, Hunter, you're new to American timelines a little bit, but we've talked a lot about throughout the episodes. One thing that's one thing that is a common thread throughout American history is tons and tons of awful racism and misogyny and everything. And this one's going to be no different. But so when Amy and I talked about the 1942 episode, it was hard to just cram everything back into a year now that we've expanded so much on so many things. And so this was one, Dewey Beard. I didn't want to disrespect him by just saying he's a guy who lost his land, was a Native American, pushed off his land in the 1800s. And then once again, the land he was forced to go to, the reservation, was then taken from him in the 1940s so they could build a bombing site, you know, to test bombs and stuff.
Sounds about right.
That's basically what he is. But he, so looking at him, was like, poor fucking guy. He was like forced off his land in the 1880s or something. His name became Dewey Beard. He was born Iron Hale in 1858, but he was a Lakota who fought in the Battle of Little Bighorn as a teenager, and he was if you don't know, is Custer's Last Stand, which we've all heard Custer's Last Stand, but I didn't know what that was. Did you know what Custer's Last Stand was? Are you into that?
No, so I grew up in North Carolina. Our social studies classes love to downplay things that America did wrong.
Okay. So yes, they don't talk about it a lot. Yeah, well, in Ohio, the same thing.
I feel like we're going to get into talking about.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it all today, so you can cover all that stuff. So I never knew what Custer's Last Stand was. I didn't know about Battle of Little Bighorn. I'm sure I've heard of it. He followed Sitting Bull into exile in Canada and then back to South Dakota, where he lived on the Cheyenne River Indian Reservation. And it was in Dewey and Zeebock County. That's where he got his name, Dewey Beard, I think. But and that's the reservation. They later kicked him off in the 40s for war stuff. And then so it's like you've already displaced these people so many times, and then you're going to just do it again. So this game has given me the opportunity to learn and talk about some things that I wasn't really aware of. So I thought, let's look it up and let's just talk about it. So we're going to kind of learn and talk about this as instead of just saying he's that guy that that happened to. I want to get into this. Like, how does the timeline work that it's even weird to me that somebody was around for Custer's last stand and World War II. You know, it's like 1800s and 1940 seem impossible to be in the same lifetime, but that's how little I know about this stuff. So that's what I kind of want to talk about. So feel free at any point, Hunter, to interject anything or to ask more questions.
Go ahead. That he was you think he was named after Dewey County? I'm thinking maybe Dewey County was named after him. Wouldn't that make a little more sense?
Oh, maybe.
When I thought Dewey Beard, I was kind of thinking like almost the literal sense, like a Dewey Beard, you know.
Well, he changed his name to Dewey Beard after something. And I looked up, we'll have to get back to it because I did this research a couple weeks ago when you and I did this, and I've forgotten it all because I have the memory of a sea slug. But first, so I wanted to stop, go, he was in the Battle of Little Bighorn as a teenager. I wanted to look up Battle of Little Bighorn, didn't know what it was. I know Little Bighorn, Montana, it's a Little Bighorn River. And that's where the battle took place. The river is called Little Bighorn. And this Battle of Little Bighorn is the same thing as Custer's Last Stand. I didn't know that. I thought Custer's Last Stand was a Revolutionary War thing that happened. You know, I knew it was Custer because he was, right? So I had ignorant. I didn't know that it had to do with Native Americans. So
I feel like, you know, that was probably correction later in the times, so us recognizing, hey, it's not all about us. We need to.
Well, and it's only somewhat recently that they'll admit that Custer didn't win. You know, like,
yeah,
we whitewash history so much that there's a big movement, and I'll get into this, to like kind of just say, he never lost anything. Let's just erase all that. That's like with George Washington. Like, you know, that guy lost some shit. But when we tell the story, he's invincible. He's been shot a million times and never did anything
wrong.
Wooden
teeth. Like, tearing at the British heels.
Can't not tell a lie. Like, we so whitewash everything. I mean, just the fact that, you know, the country was built on separation of church and state, but, oh, God's on our money. Yeah, but God wasn't on our money till the 50s, you assholes. Like, everybody acts like it was back then, but it wasn't. You know, it's not like this. So this is more. They brush over this. So, but luckily, Wikipedia has it all. Hopefully, it's true. So the Battle of Little Bighorn, known as Custer's Last Stand, was known to the Lakota and the Plains Indians as the Battle of the Greasy Grass. So they don't even call it that. That's what they call it, the Greasy Grass. Commonly referred to as Custer's Last Stand, was an armed engagement between combined forces of the Lakota Sioux, the Northern Cheyenne, and the Arapaho tribes. So if I say anything's wrong, sorry, I'm only 0.001% Native American, which my father thought we were like 25%. Anyway, so sorry I'm saying it wrong, but it was the combined forces of the Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and Arapaho tribes and the 7th Cavalry Regiment of the U.S. Army. The battle resulted in the defeat of U.S. forces, and it was the most significant action of the Great Sioux War of 1876. It took place June 25th to 26th of 1876. That's 100 years before I was born, along the Little Bighorn River in the Crow Indian Reservation in southeastern Montana Territory. So I think that's where I also, like, history-wise, like, it's hard for me to fathom. Like, I know on the Wild West and all that is the 1800s, and Abe Lincoln was there, Civil War. Like, it's all just like, what's the order of it all? And so I think what baffles me most too is that I think we think of it as cowboys and Indians, as Native Americans versus, but there were so many intertribal battles even way before even white men got here. There was all like the Native American people weren't all just one tribe, you know. It was, so I think that's the one thing like people just forget about. Like they were at war with each other, and then they, the white man, like took advantage of that a lot of times. And,
yeah, so like, so Wikipedia I can see listed here is the, so the units were the nations of the great nations of the plains, mm-hmm. which, you know, are the Native American nations that you just listed, against basically the U.S. Army.
Army, so yeah, the U.S. The Army,
Cavalry Regiment, yeah, you know?
Right.
So definitely banded together to kind of like be like, hey, you know, enough of what we're doing. We need to come together to fight Thanos. You know,
yeah.
Bring the Avengers together.
And that's what I like right away. I was like, well, shit, when was the Civil War? You know, like compared to this, like, you know. And if I Google it, it takes me to the movie Civil War. You know, you can't even. It's like that 1, 2, 3. You know, you Google Civil War, it's way down the page, the actual Civil War. Everything's
well,
about
that's
the movie.
Also your Google algorithm.
My Google algorithm thinks I care about the movie more than history. But I have a fucking history podcast. You'd think it would. So the Civil War is 1861.
Oh, you mean the new Civil War movie? I thought you were talking about Captain America.
No, that didn't come up at all. Just there's a brand new one. I don't even know what it is. Is it actually about Civil War?
Yeah, well,
you know,
so,
what it is? The new movie. So
I've been thinking about going to see it. It's very controversial, but it's basically a rogue president, basically kind of goes crazy. California and Texas band together and secede from the Union.
Oh, geez.
And go to war with the rest of the United States. So it's kind of, you know, it's very politically driven. Right.
Gotcha.
Now.
So it's like, because everybody's talking.
Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec.
He's in it.
He's the rogue president.
Oh, really? You're kidding.
And then, Spider-Man's girlfriend from the original movies.
Gosh, the original movies.
What's her name? Kirsten Dunst.
Oh yeah, Kirsten Dunst.
She's a reporter, kind of moving around the battlefield in the movie. She's the main character.
Whoa, I have no idea. This is not on my radar at all.
You want to do American Timelines field trip?
Yeah, I want to see that now. Okay. But
yeah, let's go do it.
I haven't seen a movie in theater in forever, but it sounds good.
Oh, yeah,
but
it's you said a that.
Serious movie.
Yes, it's a serious movie.
Because Ron Swanson,
obviously fiction.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Nobody's a serious character. He's good at serious characters. Did you watch The Last of Us?
No. Mm-hmm. I only watch old Barney Miller episodes. All right, so
yeah, your backlog is is wild.
Back to the Battle of Bighorn, so we can learn about this. So it's what, like 10, 15-ish years after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think of the Civil War in your mind, it's Americans. We just whitewash, like I said, we whitewash everything. Civil War was over. We beat the evil British. We have independence. Now we're a great free country that now has to continue to destroy Native Americans. So most battles in the Great Sioux War, including the Battle of the Little Bighorn, were on lands those natives had taken from other tribes since 1851. So this is the kind of thing where it's like, oh, geez, yeah, that probably happened too. The Lakotas were there without consent from the local Crow tribe, which had a treaty on the area. Already in 1873, Crow chief Blackfoot had called for U.S. military actions against the native intruders. So that's the thing that you don't think about or hear about. It's like Native American tribes being at war and then using the U.S. military to help them fight other Native Americans, which... is very uncomfortable that that happened.
Enemy of my enemy is my friend, kind of deal.
That's right. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And you know they don't have good intentions. You can't trust them. They're going to, as soon as they get them off their land, now they turn to you, probably. The Steady Lakota invasion, a reaction to white encroachment into the Black Hills, into treaty areas belonging to the smaller tribes, ensured the United States a firm Indian alliance with the Arikaras and the Crows. during the Lakota Wars. So for me, Lakota is a big Native American name that I grew up knowing, because in Ohio, Northwest Ohio, there's a school called, in an area called Lakota. And we used to play Lakota I went to Northwood and we played against Lakota. We hated those Lakota kids, but I never thought about
the fact. You know, it's Cherokee for us down here.
This Cherokee is the big thing, right? Well, so the Waxaw Indians where I live, the Waxaw tribe, they're I guess kind of related to the Catawba.
Yep, I was gonna say the Catawba.
There's a Catawba. What is it, the Catawba River down here?
Yes,
And up where I'm from, there's the Catawba Lake. Is it Lake Catawba? There's a Catawba in Ohio too. So I'm
probably. Really probably what feeds the Catawba River.
Yeah, it probably comes down into the where I see again geography. Now I got to jump into that. But anyway, the fight was an overwhelming victory for the Lakota, Northern Cheyenne, and the Arapaho, who were led by several major war leaders, including Crazy Horse and Chief Gall, and had been inspired by the visions of Sitting Bull.
I know you're not going to try and pronounce
that. No, yeah, you're looking at the same thing as I am. I'm not going to pronounce his actual name. So, but that's the thing is, like, you hear Crazy Horse, you hear Sitting Bull, but you don't really know what they really did. The U.S. 7th Cavalry, a force of 700 men commanded by Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, a brevetted major general during the American Civil War, suffered a major defeat. Five of the 7th Cavalry's 12 companies were wiped out, and Custer was killed, as were two of his brothers, his nephew and his brother-in-law. The total U.S. casualty count included 268 dead and 55 severely wounded. Six died later from their wounds, including four Crow Indian scouts and at least two Arikara Indian scouts. Arikara, am I saying that wrong? Public response to the Great Sioux War varied in the immediate aftermath of the battle, and Custer's widow, Libby Custer, soon worked to burnish her husband's memory. And during the following decades, Custer and his troops came to be considered heroic figures in American history. And the battle and Custer's actions in particular have been studied extensively by historians. Excuse me. Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument honors those who fought on both sides. So I kind of took a sidetrack when I got to Libby Custer, because I don't know if you see the picture of her. I don't know if you're looking at her online, but she's very attractive.
I'm seeing a very old black and white photo here, Joe.
Maybe I'm not. Maybe she's not the one I'm thinking of. Somebody very attractive that I looked at three weeks ago.
She's not an unattractive woman. I'll say.
I thought she's cute for a.
She looks small, which I think is common for like a lot of.
She's kind of a cute little. I mean, man. If you look at him, look at what Custer looked like.
Yeah.
She's way more attractive than he is.
I'd be curious to know how tall she is.
She looks petite.
She looks very small.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about her because, again, it fascinates me. Maybe it's these Nerdy Night shows that I've presented that are women's history of little-known women you've heard through history, and women obviously don't get a lot of the fame that men have throughout the years, that it's always like fascinating to me of just like spouses of these huge names. Like, everybody knows General Custer. I didn't even know he had a wife. I didn't know her name was Libby. I didn't know she was cute. But after her husband, five of the 12 companies of the 7th Cavalry were wiped out at the Battle of Little Bighorn in June 1876, many in the press, army, and government criticized Custer for having blundered into a massacre. President Grant publicly blamed him for the disaster, and then, fearing that her husband would be made a scapegoat by history, Elizabeth Custer, Libby, launched a one-woman campaign to rehabilitate her husband's image. Her assistance to Frederick Whitaker, the author of the first biography of George, helped enable the rapid production of the popular book, which praised George's career and set the tone for future biographers in the decades that followed. So I don't know if it's true, you know, if she's just lying about it, but you could see how she'd want to do that. So she wanted her husband George to be...
At least this Wikipedia page makes it seem, you know, I mean, they're presenting her as, you know, wife to the martyred husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't think it's just her opinion of her. She
began writing articles and making speaking engagements, praising the glory of what she presented as her martyred husband. She had three books, Boots and Saddles in 1885, Tenting on the Plains, 1887, and Following the Guidon, 1890, aimed at glorifying her husband's memory and were ultimately slanted in George's favor. And so I looked at a Wikipedia page, and under married life, it said that she and her husband George had a loving but tumultuous relationship. I guess that means he beat her probably then. I don't know. Don't you assume? Maybe not. Hopefully not. Both were stubborn, opinionated, and ambitious. Their private correspondence.
Aren't all good relationships, Joe?
I guess. I don't know. Yeah. My wife is stubborn, opinionated, and ambitious.
But you don't beat her.
But we don't have a tumult. No,
right, Joe? My wife, on the podcast.
I do not. Everyone knows from listening to this that Amy could wipe the floor with me. You can probably just tell. Anyway, their private correspondence. So George Custer and Elizabeth Custer, they had private correspondence that was filled with sexually charged double entendres. Doesn't that make you want to read it? I want to read their letters.
Especially like old-timey. Old-timey double entendres like that must be so like.
Oh, yeah. I love reading the correspondence between. There's a whole book about John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and their letters back and forth to each other. And then like somebody, was it George Washington, had a bunch of letters to what his best friend's wife that he was had a crush on, Sally. I can't remember her last name. But then George, I think George's, shit, some president, it was John, Miss Abigail Adams might have burned all her correspondence with John Adams. Like somebody burned them all. It was like, oh, I think it was Mary Washington burned all her letters. And so you never saw what was in that, you know, like, and then James Buchanan's the first gay president. Oh, anyway, what?
I Google searched Elizabeth and George Custer dirty talk.
Yeah.
And
is there a book?
The first article is titled "Those Lusty Custers, Victorian Sexters." So man, yeah,
that's a book.
Yeah, this is an article.
Oh, it's an article
about their correspondence.
I'm sure you can see it somewhere. You can find it somewhere.
You keep going. I'll find it.
There's probably a podcast about it, I would guess. Yeah. Well, so I wanted to talk more about Libby Custer, because again, this is women's history. That's cool. She was born Elizabeth Libby Bacon. She was born in 1842 in Monroe, Michigan, which is right outside of Toledo, where I'm from. She was the daughter of Daniel Bacon, who was born in 1798. A wealthy and influential judge and a state representative. So her father was a big deal. Tragedy marked much of her childhood, with her three siblings and mother all dying before her 13th year. So three of her siblings and her mom were all dead by the time she was 13. She was the only one of the judge's children who lived to adulthood. Her father would dote on her because of this. Elizabeth was both beautiful and intelligent. She graduated from a girls' seminary in June 1862 at the head of her class. Her father hoped she would make a good marriage with a man from her own elevated social status, as she rejected several suitors, including Custer. See, she was hot, and he looked like Jake the Snake Roberts, is what I put in my notes here. He's like a skeevy-looking guy. Of course, she should have been with somebody better.
Everyone loves a bad boy.
Yeah, they do. Well, she had briefly encountered her future husband, George Armstrong Custer, as a child, and socially met him again in the autumn of 1862 when he had returned to Monroe on leave from the first year of the American Civil War. He later wrote that he felt deeply in love with her as of their first formal meeting, and she eventually returned those feelings, but her father refused to allow then-Captain Custer into the Bacon home or permit her to meet him outside it, much less get married, as George proposed in the final week of 1862. See, he was from a poor, undistinguished family, and the judge hoped his daughter would have better than the life of an army wife. After Custer, just prior to the Battle of Gettysburg, where he played a significant role, after he was promoted to brigadier, I don't know how you say that, general, Judge Bacon finally relented, and they were married in Monroe at the First Presbyterian Church on February 9th, 1864. I don't know. To me, it's like fascinating to learn about stuff that happened right around where you're from, and Toledo's right by Monroe. Side note about Custer. I have a note that this is a myth buster. Custer graduated from West Point, and though he had been misleadingly characterized as an inept student for having been the last in his graduating class. Everyone says this about Custer. He was the last in his class, and look, he was the, you know, he was the hero. He actually finished 34th out of a starting class of 108 candidates. So he wasn't last in his class at West Point, but that's a myth they always say about Custer. Oh, he was last in class, but look what he did. He wasn't. So I'm myth-busting that right here on American Timelines. Back to Iron Hail. Do you remember who that was? Dewey Beard.
Well, so real quick before we get away from
before Custer, we get back to
I found the dirty.
Oh, we got some dirt. Can you read some of the dirty stuff?
So yes, it's it's all like double entendre, not
horny. Don't get you're not gonna get a boner, everybody.
But so this article said Libby's letters to her husband during the Civil War were so hot that he actually admonished her to tone it down. Not because he didn't like it or it was unladylike, but out of security concerns. His admonishment came after his dispatches were captured by Confederate raiders. The thought of his wife's intimate banter being read and guffawed at by Confederate intelligence officers would have been mortifying. And then here's the with Libby back in Monroe, Michigan, he wrote her that he was, quote, nearly starved for a ride. But I cannot, without great expense and much danger, enjoy the luxury of such a ride as that I refer to. I never did enjoy riding strange horses, end quote.
Yeah, that's pretty
filthy.
Yeah, I mean, you think of all these 1800s people in history as being just clean as a whistle, and I mean, but everyone needs to face it. Your grandparents fucked and they had foreplay and they talked dirty to each other. Everybody needs to know that. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So back to Dewey Beard, who was born Iron Hail. He joined the Ghost Dance movement and was in Spotted Elk's band along with his parents, sibling, wife, and child. And did you know what the Ghost Dance movement
is? A little bit of it. I'm sure you're about to get into it, but
didn't know this was a thing. Yeah, it's called
the combination of their local religion and Christianity, right? Am I missing?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know about the Christianity part. But I just wrote that it was a ceremony incorporated into numerous Native American belief systems, according to teachings of the Northern Peyote spiritual leader Wovoka, renamed Jack Wilson. Proper practice of the dance would reunite the living with spirits of the dead, bring the spirits to fight on their behalf, end American westward expansion, and bring peace, prosperity, and unity to Native American people throughout the region. So it was a way to kind of pray to your dead. Like, it's almost like you're praying and dancing and bringing your dead relatives back. And that they're kind of helping you fight fight to stop westward expansion. But the basis for the ghost dance is the circle dance, which is a tradition Native American dance. The practice swept throughout much of the Western U.S., quickly reaching areas of California and Oklahoma. And as the ghost dance spread from its original source, different tribes synthesized selective aspects of the ritual with their own beliefs. So I think it's kind of like a thing that kind of became, you can kind of do your own ghost dance and it can become whatever you want it to be. But so Iron Hail, Dewey Beard was still named Iron Hail. He was involved in that. He and his family left the Cheyenne River Indian Reservation on December 23rd, 1890, with Spotted Elk and approximately 300 other mini Kanju, as they called them, and 38 Hunk Papa Lakota on a winter trek to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation to avoid the perceived trouble which was anticipated in the wake of Sitting Bull's murder at Standing Rock Indian Reservation. So that's why they were moving. There was a whole murder there, and they were like, we just got to get out of here, get away from this. It's going to be a war. It's going to be more stuff. He and his family were present at the Wounded Knee Massacre, another one which I've heard of Wounded Knee, but I didn't really know what it was. But at Wounded Knee, he was shot at three times, twice in the back, and some of his family, including his mother, father, wife, and infant child, were killed. He recounted his experience in an in-depth interview with Eli S. Ricker for a book Ricker planned to write later. And so coming out of some of this, I'm going to sidetrack to Wounded Knee and talk a little bit more about that. So Wounded Knee, so Spotted Elk was a Lakota, also known as Bigfoot, was a mini Kanju leader. I'm not sure what mini Kanju is. I didn't look that up. But he was a leader on the U.S. Army's list of troublemaking Indians. On December 29th, 1890, he was stopped while en route to convene with the remaining Lakota chiefs, and U.S. Army officers forced him to relocate with his people to a small camp close to the Pine Ridge Agency. Here, the soldiers could more closely watch the old chief. That evening, December 28th, a small band of Lakota erected their teepees on the banks of Wounded Knee Creek. And the following day, during an attempt by the officers to collect weapons from the band, one young deaf Lakota warrior refused to relinquish his arms. A struggle followed in which somebody's weapon discharged into the air, and one U.S. officer gave the command to open fire, and the Lakota responded by taking up previously confiscated weapons. And the U.S. forces responded with carbine firearms and several rapid-fire light artillery. Several rapid-fire light artillery Hotchkiss guns, which were mounted on the overlooking hill. So when the fighting had concluded, 25 U.S. soldiers lay dead, many killed by friendly fire. Among the 153 dead Lakota, most were women and children. Following the massacre, Chief Kicking Bear officially surrendered his weapon to General Nelson A. Miles. So a lot of the U.S. soldiers killed themselves and killed a bunch of women and children. So they're definitely not noble in Wounded Knee, and it just seems to be a tragedy. So Dewey Beard lost his infant child. What do we say? His wife, his mother, his father.
Mother, father, wife, and infant child.
Infant child. And this is all before the 40s where he was
looking
late.
At another Audie Murphy.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, he's just been fucking through it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why it's kind of crazy. They both were mentioned in 1942 as significant things. So, and I didn't want to just brush over them. So, So Dewey Beard changed his name from Iron Hale when he converted to Roman Catholicism. He was a member of Buffalo Bill's Wild West show for 15 years and was featured in Buffalo Bill's 1914 silent picture, The Indian Wars Refought, which I planned on watching because now I got to see this, you know. And I was just fascinated by all this. So, this is another thing, Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. That's the other thing. When I told you earlier, I was going to take another deep dive. That's what it was. So a lot of the Native Americans after a lot of these wars and stuff became like freak shows. You know, they went and traveled on freak shows to make money because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't farm because they kicked them out of their land and they kicked them off to lands that weren't farmable a lot of times. Huh. You know, they were in climates that weren't, the soil wasn't good. They kicked them off. So they had to do whatever they could. So he was a part of a Wild West show for 15 years. And they probably talked about that he was in Wounded Knee and New Sitting Bull.
Circus, really.
Yeah, kind of like a circus. It was like a circus, yeah.
Rodeo circus kind of deal, yeah.
I do want to see that film. So and then now we flash forward to the early 40s. Dewey Beard, I guess it didn't say why he named where he got the name Beard. But in the early 1940s, Beard and his wife Alice were raising horses on their land on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And then in 1942, the Department of War annexed 341,725 acres of the reservation for use as an aerial gunnery and bombing range. Beard's family was among the 125 Lakota families uprooted from their homes. They were compensated by the government for their land in installments. But those installments were too low to enable them to afford more property. And as a result, they both moved into a poor section of Rapid City, South Dakota. That's where he died in 1955 at the age of 96. Dewey Beard was the last known Lakota survivor of the Battle of Little Bighorn and the last known Lakota survivor of the Wounded Knee Massacre. And that's where it stopped. But I meant to look up this Buffalo Bill Wild West show. and the Indian Wars refought, because that film, I think white people don't like that film because it gives, I think it shows too much sympathy to Native Americans. So the Indian Wars refought film, 1914 American silent Western film that depicts several historical battles of the Indian Wars. The film was directed by Theodore Wharton and stars William F. Cody, Nelson Appleton Miles, and Charles King, all of whom participated in the actual battles depicted in the movie. Kind of like Audie Murphy, like they used actual people. The feature was produced by the Buffalo Bill Historical Picture Company and SNA Film MFG Company. The film was released in August 1914. According to modern sources, it only played in Denver and New York City because of pressure from the government, which disapproved of its content because it showed the Indians in a somewhat favorable light. It's now considered a lost film, which means you can't find it anywhere. Unless it's on the dark web.
I'm reading a little bit about the way he got Dewey Beard his name. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was hoping you would look that up. Yeah.
Beard came from. But looking at this excerpt from the American Heritage volume, Dewey Beard was speaking to David Humphreys Miller in an interview. Talks about a meeting with General Miles and how they became friends and how Beard met other high officials. After the turn of the century, Miles summoned Beard to Washington and introduced him to Admiral George Dewey, fresh from Manila Bay and the Spanish-American War. Beard later took the naval hero's surname, adding it to his old Sioux nickname, which I guess was Dewey. Was Beard.
Was Beard.
To become Dewey Beard, also known as Chief Iron Hail. So,
okay.
I didn't know that was a thing. You're like, hey, I like that guy's impressive. Let me take part of his name and add that to mine.
Well, I guess when you're completely Americanizing a Native American name, you got to get a name from somewhere.
Was the guy that I was reading about earlier, Jack Wilson in the Ghost Dance movement. He was the prophet of that movement, and I guess his Native American name was Wovoka, but later known as Jack Wilson.
Okay.
A very whitewashed name.
Very white. Yeah, Jack Wilson. So looking up George Dewey now, like you're talking about. So I could have been right. So I'm looking up his namesakes on Wikipedia. If that county was named after this guy.
I can already tell.
What's that?
You're twisting things around now.
Twisting around, yeah. But he did have school, Dewey International Elementary School, Dewey Point, Dewey Hall, Dewey Field was named after Dewey Avenue in Oklahoma, Dewey Street in St. Paul.
Oh, okay.
City of Dewey, Oklahoma was named in his honor. I don't see Dewey County. Oh, okay. No, Dewey County, Oklahoma was named in his honor.
I was going to say, there we go.
But is that what we're talking about? Was that where they were, Oklahoma?
That's interesting that's where he's from, though. You know,
Dewey
Beard was from those counties.
Yeah, well, I think he probably met him somewhere around there, area. So, yeah, it's interesting around here where I live, all these street names are down in Waxville. There's all named after people's names. There's Plyler Mill. And then there's a small, like, old cemetery nearby. They still use it. They're still burying people over here, but there's some really old. And I walk through there.
People keep dying.
Sometimes. They keep dying. Well, it's not, sometimes there's like an abandoned cemetery they don't use. But some of these gravestones, they're all, these big giant ones are all the same as the street names down here and stuff, like these historic names.
Yeah.
The ones that are big, huge, the people that ran the area.
You're saying you're going to change your name to Waxall, Joe?
Is that no. No, is nobody's that name is Waxall. It's all like Plyler Mill and John. Like there's a John Moore. There's like John Moore we know. But it's kind of funny seeing all these names and whatever. So I think, they name streets and counties after first people there pretty much. But so that's it. That's just a little bit about Dewey Beard. Just that I thought he's been through a little too much for me to just be like, in 1942 he was in Wounded Knee and all this other shit, and then he took his land again. But it's just how shitty they were, you know, to take, hey, we'll pay you for your land in installments just so we can build more bombs. you know, it's just, it's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it happens in every war, right? You know,
yeah. I mean, they got to do.
And not even in war, you know. I don't know if you've seen the Chernobyl documentary. Those guys, the guys that cleaned up the nuclear disaster, and they said, well, we'll pay you in installments. Yeah. And
right.
You know, knowing they're going to be dead in the next few years.
Yeah. Knowing that's going
to
kill
them. We won't have to pay them for long.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Humans have treated other humans shittily throughout history, and I think it's good to talk about it to just remind everybody of what people have been through, and that it's all history. We can learn from it, and you know, the least we could do is say one love to Dewey Beard. Throw pour one out for Dewey Beard. You know, let's drink to Dewey Beard. You got your whiskey. What are you drinking there, Hunter? I got a beer. I have a
Peerless Rye.
Peerless Rye. Where is that? Is that from North Carolina?
It's Kentucky. Kentucky.
I have a Divine there. Barrel Brewing here in Charlotte, North Carolina. In
those guys.
Noda. A Berliner Weiss style ale with blood orange, guava, and pineapple. It's called Drop Series Volume 1, Going Together. This I got free a long time ago. But it's been sitting in my fridge. I finally got to drink it. To Dewey Beard, my friend. Clink. Clink. But that was the Dewey Beard deep dive. And we did a deep dive on Audie Murphy. Thanks for being here, Hunter. Thanks for helping me navigate some of that stuff. I knew you'd be good for that. As long as we can research on the fly. So maybe we'll turn this deep dive biography into its own thing. And just kind of, let's look on Wikipedia, see how much we can find about people.
Find some people we like or are interesting to us. Yeah.
Yeah. Just somebody you've never heard of. Like, we learned about Libby Custer. Who would have thought we would know about how attractive Libby Custer is?
Yeah. I have a new fetish.
Yeah. You can masturbate to Libby Custer now, and you've never been able to do that before. And our listeners can too. Equal opportunity masturbation, everyone. Thanks for listening, Time Heads. Thanks for being here with Hunter Brame. Please check him out at. What is it? PilotBooBoo.com?
Pilot Babu.
Pilot Babu, not .com, but that's your Instagram handle.
It's my YouTube, Instagram.
Yeah, I gotta check
Twitter.
Out.
I don't get on Twitter at all.
You don't get on X, I guess, or whatever it is. Yeah. Yeah. Is there videos of you flying anywhere on your YouTube page
on my YouTube,
Pilot Babu?
Yep.
Check them out. I've flying, got, yeah.
Yeah, some of my first flights.
Is Brian on there? Can we see what Brian looks
Brian's
like?
Brian's not on there yet. I should take the cameras up next time.
Take a video with Brian.
I'll take it with Brian. And you Joe,
nah,
are going to fly with me.
Never
and
me.
We're going to video it.
The first thing I'm going to say is every man
we're
for
gonna
himself.
We're going to get the time heads on it. You're going to start getting
we're
gonna know,
get time
requests
heads.
From time heads.
If you guys want to fly with Hunter Brame, reach out to me at History for Jerks on Instagram. And where else am I? You can email me at joe@historyforjerks.com. Okay, man. Well, thanks for doing this, Hunter Brame. This was Hunter Brame. Follow him, like him, love him, be him, steal him away
Don't
from Brian
me.
And his girlfriend. you have the chance. Just hit him up at Pilot Boom Boom. What's the thing? Pilot Broomy?
Pilot Babu.
B-A-B-B-O.
You ever watch Peanuts Gang?
Yeah. My Sweet Babu.
My Sweet Babu.
Pilot Babu. Okay. Check them out, and we'll be back soon. Amy will be back soon because I think we've exhausted. I do have another one about that skull. I told you about that Skull Lake, right? That also happened in 1942. We might have to do a deep dive on that one. I almost did that instead. There's some in 1942. They discovered this lake, and it's not in America, I don't think, that was on a mountain somewhere, and it's filled with skulls. Anyway, thanks for listening, Time Heads. Get the fuck out of here. You have a song you want to play, Hunter? You have a can you play a song?
You're typical.
Yeah, my guy's my Matt Truman ego trip. He's got some good
now
music.
I'm obsessed with time. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. That guy's great. He's really
you're
great.
You're gonna mix it onto where I sing it there.
So now I'm obsessed with time.
Matt Truman Ego Trip is the greatest band of all time. Buy their music.